I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Welcome to Spoiler Alert, episode 89 for November 2020. I'm Duncan.
And I'm Simon.
And 1989 was a big year for film. Huge. A legendary summer of blockbuster films led by Batman, Ghostbusters 2, Lethal Weapon 2, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Back to the Future 2, and Timothy Dalton's second and sadly last outing as James Bond, License to Kill, all of which I saw in the cinema.
Wow, big year.
Big year, yeah. In some ways, this was the year that independent cinema broke with two very important films, Spike Lee's seminal Do the Right Thing and Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies and Videotape, the latter which beat out the former at the Cannes Film Festival. Spike Lee famously said, "We was robbed." at least wasn't Driving Miss Daisy. Eh? So, there were two of my favourite films, Heathers and Crimes and Misdemeanors, as well as a bunch of perfect films for a 14-year-old boy, which I was at the time. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Awesome.
Cyborg. Yes. Kickboxer.
In the same year, right?
In the same year. Ah. And damn. Oh, it's like Coppola doing the conversation.
Yeah, it's
too.
Exactly like that.
Red Scorpion.
Mm-hmm.
Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah.
I remember that. I remember when that came out and just a wall of VHSs at the rental store because they were saying, man, kids are just going to come and rent this thing.
Yeah, yeah,
buy
yeah.
the bucket load. And I don't think I've ever seen that film ever again since I was, since 1989. Also, The Abyss, Dead Poets Society, Casualties of War, Drugstore Cowboy, Henry V, My Left Foot, Mystery Train, Born on the 4th of July, and Dead Calm, which I really like as well. And the truly bizarre, mega memeable Vampire's Kiss, with Nicolas Cage turning his Nicolas Cage up to 11 and exploding 90 minutes of overpowering Nicolas Cageness onto the screen. I remember seeing this as a kid and just being thoroughly confused as to what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
Someone just got the VHS, like a friend, and was just like, let's watch this, it's about vampires. And I was just like, what is this?
Yeah, I have no idea. Man, I remember seeing, you're talking sequels, Karate Kid 3.
Oh, yeah.
From that year as well in the cinema.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw, Ice Crusade, I think, twice at the cinema, actually.
Yeah.
It's strange because, I've got to say, probably my least favourite out of that first three.
Right, yeah. It's still a great one. But yeah, out of those three, yeah. And back then, I don't remember going to see a lot of films on repeat viewings, except for the Star Wars, and that was usually because they had double bills.
Yeah.
All
right, well, last month I talked about how the 80s horror run seemed to be running out of steam, and if anything, 89 was an even poorer year for fright flicks. Sequels got worse. Halloween 5 was much weaker than the previous year's Halloween. Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5 was a step down from 4, and Friday the 13th produced maybe its worst entry, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. We've talked about it before.
Talked about all of those before.
Yeah, we've talked about all of those before. There's some leisure treasure to be sure. The grocery store splatter Intruder has lots of Raimi-esque fun, which isn't a shock since it came from Raimi buddy and collaborator Scott Spiegel. I'm a fan of Pet Sematary as well from 89. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed Warlock.
Oh, Warlock. Man, I love that film.
And of course, I will always be grateful that my co-host introduced me to the Bonkers Society. I love that film.
Yeah, that sticks in the memory.
Oh, fantastic. But the most interesting horror film to come out of 89 for me is undoubtedly Shinya Tsukamoto's Tetsuo, The Iron Man. I've said it before, but the two things I know about recent Japanese cinema, from obviously an outsider's point of view, are this. Firstly, its horror seems to be divided into two categories: eerie, effective ghost stories that are maybe light on gore but high on chills, and at the other end of the spectrum, blood-soaked spectacles in which bodies are torn to shreds in often comedic fashion. The other thing is that if a story can be told, it will be told in the most painful way possible. So if America gives us the heroics of Dirty Harry, Japan will respond with the brutality of Takeshi Kitano films. And if Hollywood gives us Iron Man or The Terminator, Japanese cinema gives us the metal sprouting grotesquery of Tetsuo. In black and white and clocking in at a lean 67 minutes. Can't believe that.
It's barely a feature film.
It's barely, eh? Tetsuo is a freaky metal body horror nightmare as torso sprout drills and steaming contraptions, cables and bolts thrusting tortuously out of their flesh. Our protagonist is kind of a superhero, which is why I made the Iron Man connection, battling another metal monstrosity in the film's wild, often stop-motion finale. But he's not the sort of superhero any sane person would dream of wanting to become. He makes the suffering of Peter Weller's character in Robocop seem mild in comparison. But what a film, eh? So original, such a blast of frenetic energy in a year of mediocre carbon copies of often only slightly better horror films. Tetsuo is a unique beast, but it also gave us a fun sequel with the awesome title of Tetsuo 2, Body Hammer.
That was my wrestling name.
Yeah, it's great, eh?
Yeah, Tetsuo is crazy. There was one I came too late. I think I probably watched it at university or something.
Yeah, I think probably I did as well.
Yeah, and it seemed to be those Japanese and Asian cinema in general was starting to have its breaking through. Speaking of breaking through. And I remember kind of escalating each time because I remember seeing Akira when I think it was my last year at school, so it was probably like 92, something like that, 91, 92. And then Tetsuo was the next one.
It shocks me Akira's as old as that.
Yeah, it's amazing. 88, I think it is.
Because we talked about it the last month.
That's
right,
yeah. And so it just seemed to be like, well, Asian film.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of introduced to it almost with Akira and then Tetsuo. It was like the next one cab off the rank. And then it was hard-boiled, I think.
Yeah,
the next thing
right.
I was like, wow, this is me. But I remember those kind of trilogy of this insane world that you were going into, which is quite exciting as a film fan to discover those things, like you say, from an outsider's point of view.
Yeah,
and probably just touching the surface. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. So, Simon, what have you been watching?
Oh, right. Well, a little bit, obviously. Not a lot at the cinema, of course, but I went way back this month watching my first film starring the silent era's brooding icon and byword for romantic leading men, Rudolph Valentino, in 1926's The Son of the Sheik.
Right.
It was the first time I'd seen him in a film. Not only perhaps Hollywood's first sequel, apparently, but the last film from the superstar as he passed away just before the film's release. The Son of the Sheik was Valentino's attempt to reignite a waning career by returning it to its roots by following up his breakthrough hit, The Sheik, from 1921. And as this is my first Valentino, I can kind of see why he was such a big deal. He's smouldering, energetic when it's called for, and surprisingly subtle for a silent film star, especially one who's often associated with the sort of broad performances mocked so brilliantly by Gene Kelly in the film Within a Film in Singing in the Rain. He plays dual roles, the son of the Sheik, of course, but he also reprises his role as the original Sheik in aged makeup that looks really convincing. Obviously, he's only been aged about 20 years, so it's not a massive stretch, but it's good work, and Valentino's plays the age well. My favourite scene has the two sheiks in the same scene, sometimes even in the same wide shot. Easy enough, even for the time, as they could simply use multiple exposure to film the performances and blend them together. That technique had been used for a while, even by the mid-20s, when this film was shot. But they really saved the best for last in the scene. At the end of it, the scene sheik walks up to Sun and puts his arm around him, all in a two-shot.
Wow.
Yeah, with both characters' faces clearly towards the camera, so that you can, like, soak in the fact that this incredible special effect is happening.
Yeah.
I was floored. The effect was so seamless, so convincing. I just couldn't see the film. I couldn't see the join that, you know, in the frame that had to exist for them to be able to do it.
Yeah.
It's just one of those great little magical movie moments.
Kind of the first time someone's done something on screen.
Yeah. It was amazing. The film itself is short, just over an hour, and short on plot as well. The son of the character Valentino played in the first film falls in love with the dancer, thinks he is betrayed by the dancer, takes his revenge, discovers he wasn't betrayed, and then rescues her just in time for a happily ever after. As in the original, it's made clear that both Valentino and a love interest, despite living in the Arabian desert and being called like the Sheik, are actually Europeans. You know, there's no race mixing here. But while they were careful to whitewash the characters, it's another narrative choice that modern audiences will have trouble with. The Sheik's revenge on the dancer is to force himself upon her. Naturally, it's implied by a fade to black as he hauls her off to the bedroom. But it's clear what's happening. She would go on to forgive him in time for the ending of the film. But man, to think that the idea that one of them wouldn't be white is an issue that audiences could not get around. But rape was something that audiences could just live with. Just amazing.
Times,
they've changed.
Yeah, and I get that. I mean, there's a constant, we could almost do an entire podcast series on looking back at films that are critically lauded or important films and the difficulty of watching them because of the politics.
Oh, I mean, I remember when I saw, Blow Up.
Mm.
And, you know, there's a threesome in that film, which apparently at the time was like, oh, my God, you know, this. Mm. But the scene where the lead slaps a woman around is like, the thing that stands out to me as a modern viewer, the threesome is nothing.
Yeah.
But the casual violence is something that's like, you know, so.
That's right.
That kind of inverting of what's acceptable is crazy.
Yeah, that's right. Interesting that you're saying they're doing the sequel. I could just imagine them in the 1926, just like, oh, like, everything in Hollywood is just sequels these days. Can't do anything original. Yeah. I wish it was back in, you know.
Yeah.
Ever since Von Stroheim stopped making films, it's just all been sequels.
Yeah.
Been
downhill. Well, this is apparently Hollywood's first sequel.
Right, yeah.
Is what they're saying. So that's, I don't know if that's 100% true. It's probably pretty hard to prove nowadays.
Yeah.
But it's certainly the first surviving sequel.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what about yourself? What have you been watching?
Well, look, it's been a tough, brutal year in many ways. And just on a micro scale, as you kind of hinted at, cinema has suffered. So it's with some joy that I can report how Auckland's independent cinemas have reacted and continued to provide entertainment.
Yeah, sure have.
And the Academy in the CBD has been a local stalwart for many years now. They were kind enough to let us for free do our photos there so many years ago. And it has been joined by the Hollywood Cinema in the western suburb of Avondale. And the Hollywood is an older refurbished cinema with a cozy foyer with red curtains that make you feel as if you're stepping back in time. And the Hollywood is carving out a loyal audience, many of whom were in force on Halloween night to watch The Fog. Now, it was sad my illustrious co-host Simon could not join us. Stuck in inclement weather in Wellington. Was it fog, perhaps, Simon?
I wish it was as something as poetic as that. No, I think it was just wind being Wellington. So and, of course, as you know, I had a ticket as well.
You did? You had a ticket. And, it was sad that you couldn't make it. Cause
it was gutted.
Yeah, and it was, as we say, fog, because we were watching John Carpenter's 1980 horror, The Fog. The cinema promised a 4D experience and drew a large crowd. And the Hollywood played it just right. And like the film itself, it was a slow burn build up to reveal its secrets. A sweeping lighthouse ray that they kind of had like this, you know, coming out every now and then, like it's like sweeping across the. And, you know, the audience were clapping when that first happened. And of course, that was timed with when Adrian Barbeau's character, you know, first. Puts the, you know,
the lighthouse
on, you know, the lamp.
So cool.
Yeah, and then they kind of had, I'd never noticed it before, but in the arch around the screen, they have these lights, but you wouldn't know they were there. And so there's just these red lights stabbing the darkness with each death that happens. So suddenly, you know, someone would get killed and these red lights would just ignite. And then fog building up, and they didn't do it too much at the beginning. And the first kind of half was pretty mellow, and then there's just a little bit of fog, and again, people clap. But as the film went on, the fog started consuming the whole audience, you know. And the figures that emerged from the mist, they had these figures just suddenly kind of turn up.
Yeah.
And it was great. Ran into a friend of the show and a friend of ours, Doug Dillerman, and he mentioned that the experience really elevated the film for him.
Yeah, right.
And I was thinking the same thing, actually, when I was there. Because I'd only seen The Fog once before, and to be honest, I found it fairly tame, especially compared to Carpenter's other thrillers like The Thing and Halloween. The Fog is more of a kind of 50s B-movie throwback.
Sure.
But on this viewing, the film's restraint was kind of part of its charm. And it was a really enjoyable experience. And I forgot that they had, is it Tom Atkins?
Yeah.
So, you know, one of my favorites from... He just makes Halloween 3 Season of the Witch so watchable. He's great in this too. Yeah. He's just peeling out the one-liners. And
he's the man, eh?
He's too cool for school in this. So, if you haven't seen The Fog, I recommend checking it out. But if you haven't seen it for a while like me, go back and have a watch. And, it's a shame. This really elevated the whole experience. But, it was worth checking out.
Yeah, no, it's a fun film. Yeah. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm glad it was a cool experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Guiltily, I almost wish it wasn't, so that I didn't have to hear about it. But
I was almost not. I was going to lie and say, oh, it's really rubbish, and not talk about the podcast.
I'm glad it was cool.
Cool. And like I say, the main thing I was just happy to report is I've been a bit of a latecomer to Hollywood. Simon, you've kind of been checking out for a long time.
Man, I was there on Sunday.
Right, yeah. And I mean, again, I was speaking to Doug and he's like, oh, I just feel like I've been here nonstop for the last month, you know. Yeah. There's a real sense of community there, and they're reasonably priced and they put on good events. And
yeah.
And just in this time when we've kind of been starved of the usual cinema experience,
yeah.
It's really good that these guys are doing stuff. So get out there and support them if you're in Auckland, and if you're visiting, definitely go and, you know, go to an event when it's there, because they deliver.
They do.
Yeah.
That when the fog returns to Antonio Bay, the men at the bottom of the sea, out in the water by Spivey Point, will rise up and search for the campfire that led them to their dark and icy death.
All right, and now it's time for No Comps. So this is the part of the podcast where we go out and watch a film, a new release. And we did go out and see a film at the Hollywood in Avondale, as it turns out.
Exactly, yeah.
And so the film we saw was Saint Maud, starring Morford Clark and Jennifer L, written and directed by Rose Glass.
In a coastal English town, the reclusive nurse Maud prays to God for a purpose and believes she may have found it when she begins a private job caring for a terminally ill dancer. As the two women get to know each other, Maud sees a soul who needs saving, but Maud's own past trauma is threatened to overwhelm her.
All right, so when I first suggested we should watch Saint Maud at the Hollywood in Avondale, that was before we found out that star Morford Clark would be coming along for a post-flick Q&A, which was a real treat. She's in the country shooting the Lord of the Rings series, so was available to chat about the film. Amongst the many things she talked about, she mentioned watching Roman Polanski's Repulsion as prep for the role. That's a good comparison. There's certainly a central section that involves too much isolation leading to too much madness and paranoia, something we can all relate to this year maybe. But in that story of a woman in touch with God in a way that may or may not be real, I'm reminded of my favourite von Trier, Breaking the Waves, as well. There's even a hint of Carrie, if Maud was maybe both mum and Carrie at the same time. But it was a real treat, I thought, to have that Q&A afterwards, specifically since it wasn't something we knew we were going to be getting.
That's right, yeah, no, that was a real treat. And yeah, like say, another good one that Hollywood pulled out. And it was, she kindly answered questions afterwards and is rightfully proud of her work, I think.
Yeah.
And I liked her talking about the audition process, which was apparently quite arduous.
Yeah,
where,
yeah.
Consisting of like, kind of 40-minute mental breakdowns, climaxing and levitation.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like the director goes, and now you levitate.
And
it was
now like, levitate. Yeah.
Which, but you know, Clark believed in the script and especially drawn to the character, thinking it was the kind of role she could inhabit.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that Morford Clark is in every scene.
Mm.
Almost every frame of this film, it is told from her point of view. So that makes it especially good she was there. It's not just, it's the lead actress. It's like she is in every single scene.
Yeah.
Her visions are treated as reality. We become absorbed in Maud's headspace. While there is still enough cinematic objectivity to remain cognizant of what is real and what is invented.
Right, sure.
Yeah. The piety displayed by Maud is strong in the opening act of the film. She has a certainty in her actions and beliefs. Even while she's asking God for guidance, and that's what the second act that was balanced beautifully, because Maud, by finding her mission, falling into temptation,
right,
and it's this nice kind of seesaw. You're not quite sure which way she's going to go.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. No, I thought she was great, actually.
Mm.
Fantastic. That sparring, teasing, oft sexually charged, sometimes friendly, sometimes not relationship between Maud and Amanda, and Amanda's semi-gothic, almost inexplicable grand seaside manner, is the heart of the film, and the two actors make it sing. Clark will get a lot of praise, no doubt, and she has been. Deserved too, she's fantastic, seemingly ghostly and otherworldly, and then emerging as a beauty in a sad attempt to fit in. There's that scene where she's, in that, I don't know what it was, whether it was a cafe or a bar, and she laughs in reaction to a joke someone else at another table is telling.
Yeah.
And it's so believably awkward, a stab at belonging, that it kind of hurts, you know?
Yeah.
She's at once wretched and dangerous, and it's quite a mix, and Clark makes it feel real and believable. But Jennifer L, I thought, was also really great, all embittered and brittle and teasing. She's the wildness that Maud either wants or wants to purge. For her part, she's smitten with Maud and her naivety. She can't resist mocking it either.
Mm.
Her smile, which can appear playful, cruel, can also be passed off as genuine at times, like a jealousy for someone who's so certain, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They have really good chemistry together, more for Clark and Jennifer Eyal. Mm. And this character is in Eyal's wheelhouse. So I haven't seen a lot of her, but what I have seen throughout the years, this is kind of perfect for her.
Kind
of aloof, elegant, acerbic.
Yeah.
And she feels very believable as a character.
Yeah.
And Eyal gives an almost Tilda Swinton-esque performance, you know, juxtaposing her high-class, plum-in-the-mouth attitude with like the brutal effects of cancer, like punishing her bodily functions.
Yeah.
And those kind of almost a defiance from her to kind of deal with it.
Mm.
And believably, as you say, she kind of grows fond of Maud while continuing to make fun of her. And Eyal's character is a figure who offers, as you say, both the salvation Maud requires and the evil Maud wants to confront.
Yeah,
which is
it's doubly a sword, eh?
It's great. And there's, like I say, a lot of this film is not so much from Maud's point of view, but it's we're focusing on what Maud's doing. But there is those moments, and probably only she's the only character, Eyal, who we see Maud through her eyes sometimes. There's that part where she's kind of writhing on the couch.
Yeah.
We kind of feel complicit slightly in her and Amanda's character kind of looking at this, you know, with wonder and disbelieving, but also amazement, but kind of ridicule. And it's all mixed together. Yeah, and it's just
great.
in the face. And those moments were really good.
Yeah. One of the things that, just on that, one of the other things Clark talked about was being drawn to a film without any villains. So no one's necessarily a bad person here, just confused, lonely, or lost perhaps. But I was also struck that this was a film about women and their relationships. There are men in St. Maud, but none at the centre and none ultimately impacting events or driving the narrative in any way. This is all about Maud and Amanda, with only Amanda's sometime lover Carol or Maud's old nursing friend Joy complicating the story or providing another road which Maud could choose to turn down if she can see it. Another choice she could make. So I thought that was really interesting. It was a really female-led film.
It's almost an incidental thing you think of afterwards, isn't it? It's not something you're aware. I wasn't aware of when.
No, I'm not even sure when it occurred to me that, like, I just watched a movie in which, you know, the men have, I don't know, a handful of lines, if that.
Yeah, and they're kind of no discernible, memorable male character at all.
Yeah, yeah.
The film has dark comedic elements, both awkward and direct. Maud herself is capable of delivering the humour as well, and sometimes it is at her expense. Mm. She's capable of both. And there's a scene just before the climax that teeters on the edge of comedy and suspense. A blissfully ignorant fellow nurse drops in on a spiralling Maud.
Yeah.
And the tension for the viewer is palpable. And there has been no real action that leads us to fear for anyone's safety, but yet we do. Like, there's nothing actually that's happened so far that makes you think, but you know there's this sense of dread and this character who's just kind of blissfully unaware of what Maud's going through, but we are. And Maud hasn't done anything that indicates anyone's in any danger, but yet we fear. And I think that was just a masterful, because it was comedic, it was awkward, it was a tense scene.
Yeah.
Look, the question we often ask is this a successful horror film?
Right.
St. Maud doesn't wish to scare us in the traditional sense. It wants to suffocate us until we walk toward the inevitable climax with the lead character. The film is mercifully free of jump scares, with only the finale dipping into kind of familiar horror tropes.
Mm. Yeah.
And by that point, we know exactly what it really means, that scene. We're well aware. Yeah, and with a kind of final startling shot to sear into your brain the bleak reality of what is going on.
I mean, this and the other film we're going to talk about this month, now you get to a stage in talking about them that it becomes difficult to speak of them without giving too much away. So
that's right. Yeah.
It becomes a bit of a challenge.
I found this was an interesting film because it's not a straightforward horror. Like, it's not, you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing particularly horrific about it. It's a psychological horror.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the thing for me is this is just a really quality film, you know. I've said it many times before. We're in the golden age of horror, where art house films are slamming up against horror themes and giving us, you know, the Babadook, if we're going to go back that far. It follows The Witch, Hereditary, The Eyes of My Mother, and the list goes on and on. St. Maud is beautiful to look at. The cinematography by Ben Fortzman is exquisite, you know, turning Maud's rented room from simply drab sometimes to like a horror show of imprisonment and spiraling madness. Composer Adam Janowski.
Mm-hmm. Well done.
Thank you. Delivers up an unnerving score of demonic buzzing drones. It does that rare horror trick of not just commenting on the horror, but creating it, something that my beloved Goblin were masters of. And as we've said, Moffat Clark is wonderful. But I'm going to play a slight Scrooge here and say that St. Moore doesn't stick with me in the way that the films that have inspired it perhaps do. And part of that might be the fantastic trailer's fault, which lured me in, but also spoilt the film's best gross-out moment involving a shoe and some foot trauma.
Right.
But I also think it's because I always knew more or less where this film was going. Sure, it has a final shot that manages to be both traumatic and hilarious, depending on the blackness of your sense of humour, I think. And which certainly goes some way to making me love this film as well. But for the most part, this is a relatively surprise-free ride. I think the scene you talked about with her friend visiting her might have been one of the few exceptions where I was a little bit more on nerve, on edge about where it was going. But if you ask me after about the first third of this film how I thought the film would end, I think I probably could have told you, more or less, you know. And the horror elements can, for me at least, edge a little bit towards familiarity. Cockroaches scuttling over the ceiling, a levitation out of The Exorcist. Even the mantra, never waste your pain, feels like a riff on a line from Hellraiser's iconic Pinhead. So for me, there's like so much to love. It's a well-made flick of great performances and a hell of a start for writer-director Glass. First film, and also the first film Moffat Clark leads.
That's right.
So I mean, that's pretty great debuts right there, aren't
it? Yeah, look, I think that the faith that, as we spoke about, that Clark had in the script is justified. And Glass's film is I thought it was taut. There's no excess dialogue. That's shot through with dark humour, even some light humour in there as well. Like the first moment when the when she's kind of relieving the nurse, you know, her first kind of opening line is to, you know, what's the patient like? You know, her response to that is just classic British humour, you know, like kind of blunt and to the point. But this, you know, what I did find with this is that I was engaged from the opening frame to the last, and falling into the psychological horror category and the tradition of its very direct influence repulsion. And like that film, it is centred around a calling card performance for its lead actor. So, I really enjoyed this film, and I recommend checking it out if you get an opportunity to.
Bless Amanda's body, which is hurting now, but has done so many wonderful things. And bless her mind, which is shrouded in darkness. And reach out to her like you did to me. Amen.
Seeing as it was Halloween, we decided we'd just tag on another kind of companion film for this one that was in the similar vein to St. Maud, and that was the recent film, well, in the last 5 years, I think it's 2015. The Black Coat's Daughter, written and directed by Osgood Perkins, starring Emma Roberts, Kiernan Shipka, and Lucy Boynton.
Two girls left behind at a Catholic boarding school over winter break. Left in the care of a pair of nuns, they face a supernatural presence. Meanwhile, a disturbed young woman is given a lift by a couple on a trip that takes them to the same boarding school. Which is, I think, a fairly decent spoiler-free summary, I guess.
Yeah, well done.
Thank you. Any more and we'd definitely be in trouble, eh?
Yeah, I think, there's going to be an interesting one to kind of navigate through this one.
Sure.
Even more than St. Maud.
Yeah. Look, I think this film turned out to be a better match for St. Maud than I could possibly have hoped for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a film I've been wanting to see for a while, but I had no idea that both these films would be about young women grappling with faith and loneliness and perhaps on the edge of madness, though the faith is very different in both cases.
That's right.
They both have strong, largely female casts. They're both films that have been described as slow burns, and they're both films from first-time directors. And also, I like them both a heck of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Though I'm going to give the edge for me maybe to Perkins here, actually, which might be a bit of an unusual take given the near unanimous love for Heading St. Maud's Way. But I really did like this film.
Well, I think we're going to disagree on this.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I found this a really distancing film. The characters feel separated from reality from the beginning, and therefore I found it difficult to sympathise with their plights quite a lot. The film grimly clings to its art house horror mood and non-linear structure. Its adore wintry setting provides an appropriate backdrop for a movie about loneliness, separation from family blood, and separation from humanity through the spilling of blood. The music is effective, the structure keeps the mystery of the story intact until the end, and the film will benefit, I think, from a repeat viewing, but I'm probably not going to be the person who's going to go back and watch this again.
Oh, right. Whereas I think I definitely will, because I also feel it would benefit from a second viewing. Mm. So, look, just a little background before we get into our dueling films. This is the first film by Osgood Perkins, the son of legendary psycho star Anthony Perkins. It slipped out actually after his second film, I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, which is a great title, by the way, although it had a pre-life, I believe, on Netflix, with the hideously forgettable title February.
Right, yeah.
February. So for many people, this might not have been the first they'd heard of Osgood Perkins, and they might have heard about him, you know, through I'm the Pretty Thing. Look, there's a little bit of Rosemary's Baby and a bit of Lynch and Black Coat Daughter's DNA, I think. The Girls in School Before It Breaks for the Holiday had a slightly Twin Peaks vibe for me. And the school is called Bramford, after all, which is the same name as the sinister apartment building from Rosemary's Baby. So Perkins is definitely wearing his influences on his sleeve, but he's also messing with our own expectations a bit, I think. We've seen evil boarding schools before. I mean, Suspiria, right? If I see young girls of that age at a boarding school, I automatically think it's Suspiria. So we have genre expectations that aren't followed through with, and the relationship with evil is a little more twisted than we might expect. Also, Perkins' command of menace and slow build suspense really works for me. It starts by having everything just a little bit off. Kenan Shipka's performance as the distant, distracted, haunted young cat helps immeasurably for me. The way when people talk to her, she just zones out, smiling into thin air, which will get addressed later in the film, I think. And when she glances back, it almost feels like it's watching someone acting in reverse. You know, she's got this strange way of just pulling back into focus, as if the blink happens in the wrong place, you know? It's eerie, but the pacing and the structure are really effective as well for me. The way the film jumps between POVs and replays events from different angles, introducing a twist in time about halfway through that I didn't see coming. It could come across as gimmicky, but it really worked for me. And like we talked about a rewatch, already I'm looking forward to a rewatch, so I can see how the connective tissue brings it all together and how, in particular, Shipka sets up events to come.
Yeah, the performances are dedicated. Kenan Shipka, who spent years perfecting her icy demeanor in Mad Men, is the standout performer here. She wears a plastic expression throughout the majority of the film, and if you've seen Mad Men, you know that she, you know, it's kind of perfect casting,
yeah,
really.
Right. I haven't seen that, so
yeah, and she's great in it, and she's, you know, not saying she's stereotyped, but it's like, yeah, that's, you know, it's like if you cast Christopher Walken as a slightly wacky villain, you're like, yeah, you're still going to get a great villain, but that's his wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But she's really good in this. The cold location, absorbing her personality as she becomes divorced from relatable human behaviour in some ways. The exception being a scene towards the end, which she shows quite a lot of really strong emotional denouement for the lead character. And again, I don't want to give anything away, but this is the scene that remained with me the most after I watched the movie. And
the final scene?
The final scene she's in.
Yeah.
Mainly because of its subtle subversion of genre expectations.
Yeah.
And Shipka.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and Shipka's kind of desperate, quiet plea is quite memorably unnerving in that.
Yeah. Okay, moving on. And a bit of a plot spoiler here, but this film has an exorcism. And I need to talk about it because I didn't love it. Mm-hmm. I actually thought it was well handled, brief, nicely shot, well performed, but I'll get to what I liked about it. I didn't like it because the film didn't seem to be heading towards the scene, if you know what I mean. And perhaps that's kind of went from zero to spraying holy water in no time. And yet I was brought up on William Friedkin's The Exorcist and the line from Father Karras that if you want an exorcism, the first thing you need is a time machine. So exorcisms from nowhere is a little bit for me to take, you know. But like I say, well shot, underplayed and all. But what I did really like about the scene is it's the first time I've seen a film show an exorcism from the point of view of the exorcised. Or is it the exorcisee? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's still pretty uncommon. There's a German film called Requiem I've yet to find a copy of, which tells the story of a supposed possession from the point of view of the girl who undergoes it. Which, when you think about it, is harsh viewing.
Yeah.
It has to be. Yeah. And that's the only other film I can think of which does this. So it's kind of a unique twist on that sort of scene, you know?
Yeah. It is an unusual scene. Like, actually, that's a good point. You say kind of... But this is I guess this is a film, and this is probably where I... Because it is so cut up and, you know, shifting everywhere, it's hard to kind of get a foothold on what's going on anyway a lot of the time. You don't necessarily know how far you are from the end or anything. So, so it's interesting, like, that. Now that you mention it, you're like, oh, I guess that kind of does come out of nowhere, but a lot of things come out of nowhere in this film.
Right.
I
will concede that Black Toad's Daughter manages its kind of its landing with some head-scratching narrative turns. But you know what? I'll allow them, you know. I'll also add that both films finish, you know, when I'm comparing them to St. Maud's, with similar questions posed. And without going into spoilery detail, I will say I got a kick out of St. Maud's grim, very blackly funny ending. But Blackcoat's ending is something else again, I think. It's sort of a dark moment of tragedy and abandonment that has occupied space in my head long after I stopped watching it.
Right.
And so from that point of view, I think I will look forward to a second watch, you know?
I was probably just more merciful that it was done.
Oh, man.
At that point, because I found the film, there's things to admire in it.
Yeah.
And it felt very constructed. That's what I mean. Like, I didn't feel engaged. I didn't quite know what anyone's journey was in this. I didn't know who I was supposed to be sympathizing with, right, really, as characters.
Right.
There's often been a criticism of, and this is a film that it references, again, in its setting and its weather, The Shining. And there was someone who kind of said, well, the thing with Jack Nicholson, The Shining, is he just goes off the rails from the beginning. He's nuts,
yep,
you know, and he's Jack Nicholson, so, you know.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt like that with this, where I'm just like, here's your character, and she's completely off the boil immediately.
Right.
Like, okay. So who am I supposed to be kind of connecting with here?
Yeah.
And and there's a, not giving anything away, but there's a time jump, which,
sure,
with another actor coming in, and that was problematic
for
me with who they cast, age wise. But also the other thing was I could kind of tell where that was going.
Right.
Right. So, and some people may not, so they might get a kick out of that. So again, it's something being really careful not to spoil anything here. But yeah, that was something where I'm like, okay, I can kind of see what's going on here.
You see, I didn't, so that probably held up there for me.
Right.
It's a narrative issue.
Yeah.
And your mileage may vary. But I guess because I didn't immediately pick up on what they were doing, it had a better impact for me.
Yeah.
This is just a personal thing, but unless I'm cued for some sort of twisty kind of M. Night Shyamalan kind of deal, I'll never spot them.
Right.
Yeah, because I'm that guy who's just taking the story in as it happens and watching various things, but I'm not trying to think ahead to what I'm being set up for. So I would be the easiest mark for like a magic trick, eh? You know?
I
almost never spot it coming.
Yeah, you're going to be like one of those suckers in like a mammoth film who just get taken for, like House of Games.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just, you know. It's
taken
for everything. Like a fool, eh?
Yeah.
In any film noir, eh? You know? I'd be realising at the 85-minute mark, what?
Yeah, you would just be the husband in Double Indemnity, you know, while Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray are behind your back.
The end, that end thing would be coming up, and I still wouldn't have realised what had happened to me.
So with these modern, and as you say, we're in this kind of golden age of horror, and these modern art house horror films lies the question again. I go back to the same morning, and does it work as actual horror? And for me, it didn't in some ways. It has tragic elements, some violence, but the film doesn't have any. I didn't find anything scary in the film. Like, it didn't engage me. I didn't feel suspense a lot or dread. There were images that were cool and were like, oh, that's a bit strange. Like, there's that the very almost Blair Witch-esque kind of thing where one of the characters is flailing back and forth in front of like almost in prayer. And in front of a furnace. That kind of stuff was, oh yeah, that's cool. So there was kind of images that grabbed me, but there was no kind of scenes that I will stick where I'll be like, wow, that was a really great suspenseful scene or anything. It has bursts of violence, which are bloody and prolonged and kind of coldly displayed. Like, similar in their realistic depiction to this like sparse stabbing in David Fincher's Zodiac. There's that scene in Zodiac, which I really love Zodiac so much. And which is in kind of broad daylight and is like shot from wide. And this kind of reminded me of that in some ways, where it was just like, this feels just kind of brutal. And look, I have to say, and I may have not been in the right frame of mind to watch Blackcoat's Daughter at the time, because I did find an agitating watch. And ultimately the issue for me is that it keeps the viewer at arm's length by being obscure. This is a problem because it doesn't want to trade in genre conventions. So There is originality in how it's structured, which I liked. But if you structured this a different way, and I guess you could say, like St. Maud is more of a linear thing.
Yeah.
So if you structured it in the same way, it probably wouldn't be as effective. Because the part that made me go, oh, I guess I would be interested in seeing that again, is really like kind of watching it now that I know what it, you know what I mean? What the end is. Whereas if you told that in linear fashion, you'd be like, oh, whatever.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm not surprised that you liked it. I knew watching this, I was like, I bet Simon's going to like this.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're more of a horror aficionado than me as well. So, and perhaps because the characters in St. Maud were relatable or that it had dollops of humor, something to kind of cling on to again, I've kind of felt more engaging. So maybe it's just I'm a bit more kind of vanilla in my taste when it came to that. And to me, like Black Coat, what I mean, say something like St. Maud, I think I could handily say to someone, watch this, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Whereas I think Black Coat's Daughter it's a bit of a Marmite film, right? So you're either going to be kind of invigorated and
look, I 100% understand where you're coming from.
Or it'll be like, well, that will kind of repel you. Because it is an agitating, that kind of... But it's like some stuff in there I really like say the visuals, Shipka's performance, even the music, like was a big...
The music by Elvis Perkins, so Osgood Perkins' brother.
Right, okay, yeah, there you go.
Family affair.
Yeah,
I really like that music as well, all sonic drones and things. And I mean, I thought for me that there was some tension in there, particularly there's a scene where one of the girls is walking around inside the school. At that point, you know things are going south. And there's this really nice drifting camera work that uses mirrors and off-screen space in a manner that would make John Carpenter proud, I think. And I felt there was a real escalating dread there. And then, of course, violence. I completely understand that this might be everyone's cup of tea. For me, I found the coldness actually an attractive element of the film, you know. And the slightly distancing kind of intrigued me, I think. And, of course, like I say, I was caught by... I guess the twist of it. And I found the ending pretty powerful in its way and what its suggestions about faith and belief.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the kind of end emotional payoff is like interesting, again, without giving anything away, that similar to St. Maud, that final shot and what it means, you kind of, you know, St. Maud is very clear what it means, whereas this is more like, okay, but it makes you ponder what does that mean and what does... That display of emotion, particularly in that. So that's what I mean. Like, here's a film that's kind of the lead character is completely withdrawn from any emotion for basically the entire film.
Yeah.
And then show something, you're kind of like, okay, well, what does that mean? And I would recommend if you've got a stomach for edgier or strange horror films, then it's definitely one to check out.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Okay, and so that's spoiler alert for November.
Mm-hmm.
So, Simon, what's your favourite film of the month?
All right, so look. Was Bill and Ted Face the Music a good film? I don't even know, to be honest. It's a mess. The plot is wobbly and Keanu Reeves looks asleep behind the wheel, except for when he gets to play the evil version of Ted Theodore Logan Esquire. It's shambolic, but hasn't the series always been kind of shambolic somehow in its DNA? What it is very much, though, is sweet and well-meaning, and in that respect, its messiness is less important than its heart, which felt so right for the moment we're living in, particularly the moment when I saw it, which was... First film I watched coming out of the second lockdown.
Right.
Yeah. Its message is something that maybe we need to hear, delivered by a pair of lovable goofball poets and their delightful Chip of the Old Block daughters. Look, I thoroughly enjoyed Bill and Ted Face the Music. It got me the right time as we all merged from the second lockdown, wondering what the future will look like and figuring out exactly how to start again. And its warmth and optimism felt like an antidote to, you know, what's been a pretty hard year.
Nice. Oh, I'm looking forward to checking it out. I really like Bill and Ted's, the first two. I particularly love Bogus Journey. And when people wheel out the, apart from The Godfather, what second films? I'm like, hey, well, if you're speaking about The Godfather, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, I enjoy more than the original.
I don't know if I do, but I admire it. It is, the second one is so bizarre. It is weirder than you can, you know, like I think... I watched it again recently as well in the lead up to watching this, and I'd always remembered it as an odd film. It is way odder than I remembered it.
Yeah.
And visually inventive as well in a way that, like, you know, basically stoner comedies maybe shouldn't be. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
That's right.
It was so crazy, you know, recreating hell and visions and the future and aliens and heaven. You know.
Yeah.
It really went for broke. Huh?
Yeah, and, you know, like referencing Ingmar Bergman films.
Yeah,
and
then, totally.
And Ted, you know, like, I totally possess my own dad. And, you know,
that kind of, oh, I love
yo,
that
cop
stuff.
Dudes.
Yeah, and, great stuff.
Yeah, so I'm glad to hear that Face of Music is you know, enjoyable, because I really want to go.
Yeah, it is really, it's a lovely watch. Cool. And if you enjoy those characters, then, you know, you're going to enjoy watching them again, I think.
Great, cool.
And what about you?
Well, not The Black Coat's Daughter, but but look, I enjoyed St. Maud, and I enjoyed watching The Fog again, actually. And I can even recommend on Netflix the trial of the Chicago 7, Aaron Sorkin film. Good fun, you know. Sure. A lot of English actors putting on American accents. You know, Sacha Baron Cohen as Abby Hoffman and Eddie Redmayne and Mark Rylance, and they're all just putting on this American stuff. But really, you know, really enjoyable, well-written, and kind of dynamic film. But look, the one I enjoyed recently, and you've spoken about it before, actually, when it came out,
right?
And it took me a long time to get around to watching it, is Overlord.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And you spoke about Russell,
Kurt Russell's son.
Yeah, Kurt, I was trying to remember his actual name rather than Kurt.
Yeah,
Russell's
Kurt
son.
Kurt Russell's son.
Kurt Russell's son.
He's great, eh?
He is great. Yeah. But he's great, and I remember you saying this is a kind of like this macho performance.
It's a very old-fashioned sort of manliness about him, eh?
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
he's great, and the leader, forgive me, I don't know his name either, but this is really well cast. But I really enjoyed this film, and I don't know, like, the opening is straight out of Medal of Honor.
Yeah,
you know, it has an immersive experience when our lead character is pushed out of a disintegrating plane that's tumbling through the air in the middle of the night. You know, getting strafed, but and he's falling between enemy fire and other aircraft, and then the ship, the plane he's just jumped out of, it like explodes, and he's just flying down, and it's just so intense, and it's all in one shot. I mean, obviously it's a lot of CGI, but I really love how that's in one shot, and then like there's a scene right towards the end which is just one shot of him escaping this castle. It was the same thing.
Yeah.
They bring it back in. This taking its influence from, as you know, one of my favorite Boyzone adventures, Guns of the Navarone.
Yeah.
And Inglourious Basterds. Yeah. Like, it's got both, you know, elements of both of those. And the intensity of war is represented as horrific enough in that first, say, like about 20 minutes, let alone the unnatural nightmares the Nazis are creating in a tactically vital village church. Mm. And I just love that it's blending elements of war film, horror film, and video games. And Overlord is the kind of cult movie I would have really loved as a teenager. You know, like going back to about like 89 when I was 14.
For sure.
You know, as this would have been one that would have got passed around the playground on a VHS. You know, you're like, man, have you seen Overlord? Like, that's a great film. Yeah. That would have been, you know. I just really enjoyed it, and I thought it was a really...
Oh, good stuff.
Like, really fun experience from start to finish. So if you haven't seen Overlord, I recommend checking it out. But like I said, I was a bit late to the party, but yeah, I really enjoyed that. Okay, so that's a spoiler alert for this month. I just want to say one other thing is mention the passing of Sir Sean Connery as well,
of course,
passed away. And it just feels slightly weird because these last few months, like the last podcast we talked about was From Russia With Love, finally came up where I finally talked about my favourite Bond film, which, you know, after nearly 10 years of doing the podcast, I hadn't spoken in depth about it. And of course, I did the story and stuff thanks to Darren Bevan and talking about Bond. And, you know, it's kind of like Bond's kind of gone underground recently because of keep getting delayed. But Sir Sean Connery passing, and not just Bond. When Roger Moore died, it felt very much like that was a Bond thing. You know, he was a lot closer with Bond, with the fans, than Connery ever was. Connery transcended that, so it's not just Bond. You know, like, you think of all the great films he did. Yeah, you know, Marnie, you know, with Hitchcock, Robin and Marion, The Man Who Would Be King with John Huston.
I saw a lot of The Rock stories coming about. People telling stories about that.
Yeah.
Obviously, Last Crusade we talked about. I mean, what an amazing...
Yeah, Last Crusade. I mean, Untouchables, Hunt for Red October, In the Name of the Rose. I mean, I even, you know, like Outland, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And...
Sure. Zardoz?
Yeah, I've never seen Zardoz.
I've never watched it.
That's
wild, man.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard a lot about it, and obviously seen the infamous pictures.
For sure.
Yeah, and... Zardoz was apparently the film that they offered him Live and Let Die after Diamonds Are Forever, and he's like, no, too busy, I'm doing Zardoz. So I just, you know, kind of like to mark that. Obviously, you know, he had a good life and lived till he's 90 and all the rest of it, and he'd been pretty quiet for a while now. But total legend, and just kind of a shame that this year ended with that. And the song we're going out to, though,
is God Made Rock and Roll.
Yeah. This is from, we just mentioned Bill and Ted's Face to Music, but this is from the end of Bogus Journey.
Yeah.
And, yeah, originally by Kiss. And, yeah, so enjoy it. And thanks everyone for listening.
Stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Hey, and get out and see St. Maud if you get a chance.
Yeah.
It is, I'm pretty certain it is in cinemas at the moment.
Cool.
And
yeah.
It's obviously a really great film, so get out and see that. Watch Black Crow's Daughter if you like it. Yeah. Let me know. If you didn't like it, let Duncan know. I don't want to hear from you.
We can start a poll on the Black Facebook Coat's group.
Poll.
Yeah, Black Crow's Daughter poll.
And, yeah.
You can watch both. We'll put a poll in and say, which do you prefer? St. Maud or Black Coat's Daughter? We might try and do that.
I think I know how that poll's going to go. I mean, I'm not an idiot. You know?
Yeah. I'm going to start a campaign. I don't feel that strongly about it. So, yeah, I didn't hate Black Coat's Daughter. It was just, I think especially on the back of St. Maud. But yeah, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next month.
All right, take care, everyone.
Cheers.
I totally possessed my dad.